Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Barbara Marshman. I'm editor of the editorial pages of the San Jose Mercury News, and it's my pleasure to introduce E.J. Dionne, Jr., columnist for the Washington Post and author of Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. EJ's columns appear in nearly 100 national and international newspapers, including the San Jose Mercury News, I'm happy to say. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, professor at Georgetown University, and frequent political commentator on NPR, ABC's This Week, NBC's Meet the Press, and NewsHour on PBS. EJ graduated from Harvard and was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. He spent the first 14 years of his career at the New York Times, reporting from New York, Washington, Paris, Rome, and Beirut. That should about cover it. EJ is the author of several books, including the bestseller Why Americans Hate Politics, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a National Book Award nominee. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming EJ Dionne, Jr.
I just want to thank you for that and say that was a far more generous introduction than I once got. I always think of this when somebody introduces me kindly, and it ended, and now for the latest dope from Washington, here's E.J. Dionne. So thank you very much. If one other thing I'd like to say, first of all, it's great to be here in the Silicon Valley, although half of me is still in Ottumwa in Keosauqua, Iowa, where I came in from last night. But as many of you know, we journalists now, because of comments and email and all the rest, we're seen as a fairly arrogant lot. But as you know, our readers try to keep us humble. And one of my favorite repeatable emails, I actually got one like this. It said, "Dear Mr. Dionne," that was already progress. I was pretty polite. It said, "Dear Mr. Dionne, are you as dumb in person?" And so if you get nothing else out of what I have to say tonight, you'll at least be able to answer that question for yourself. But it's really, really kind of you all to come out here tonight. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we're really happy to have you here. It's delightful. I wanted to start out by challenging the entire premise of your
book.
That's
a good way to start.
Which is...
Those damn journalists. You know?
Well, that would be a different premise. I think we could... why the right went wrong. If I'm the right, which if you've ever read our paper, you know I'm not, but if I am the right, I might well think we're doing pretty well.
Right. Well, in fact, I mean, that is a good question. And let me even extend your argument that if I am the right, I say, you know, look at how many state governorships we control. Look at the fact that there are more Republican state legislators than I believe at any time since 1928. Look at the control of the House and now, for now, at least control of the Senate. Why should we have anything to worry about? And one of the things I talk about in the book, just to give you a sense of the book, the first sentence of the book is the history of contemporary American conservatism is a story of disappointment and betrayal. And one of the fundamental arguments of the book is that since the Goldwater campaign of 1964, conservatives have had to make a series of promises to their supporters that they couldn't possibly keep. A smaller government, which Ronald Reagan and none of the other Republican presidents who've taken office could achieve, a rollback of the cultural changes in the country, the results of the rights revolutions of the 60s, country doesn't want to roll those back, and increasingly a promise to change the ethnic makeup of the country back to where it might have been in 1940. Well, unless, like Mr. Trump, you're willing to deport 11 million people, you're not going to do that either. And so there's been this cycle of radicalization that comes from the broken promises, and if you wonder why Trump and Cruz are so strong in these primaries, that is one of the central reasons. There are others. But when you look at the Republican Party, Why have they won those midterm victories? Well, yes, that is very good news for them, and Democrats do have to figure out how to turn out voters in midterm elections. But one of the main reasons they're doing so well is because their constituency is so old. The Republican Party is increasingly a party of older white Americans. Young people aren't Republican. Latinos aren't Republican. Growing part of the country, Asian Americans who used to vote Republican voted 3-1 for Barack Obama in 2012. They're not Republican. Republicans in the Reagan years actually used to be a younger party. Remember the Michael J. Fox character as a kind of representative for those old enough to remember that great show. Like me, they used to be a younger party. So in the mid 1980s, Pew Research Center did a survey, and only 37% of Republicans were over the age of 50. Now over half of Republicans are over the age of 50. So the short term, this really helps you in midterm elections, and it helps you win all those state offices in midterm elections. Long term, you do not want a party so dependent. On older Americans. I mean, I have nothing against them. I'm one of them. But this is not a party of the future, and it's not a party of the future of America. Jim Brulte, the Republican state chair here in California, who's somebody I interviewed for the book, makes the point that California demographically is where the United States is going to be in about 20, 25 years. And he says very explicitly, the National Party does not want to make the mistakes that the Republican Party in California made, or the National Party will be in the same state that the Republican Party in California has been now for quite some time.
Well, you started off your life as a nice Republican boy. How did you become what you are today?
Yes, many of my relatives ask me that. particularly, actually, I grew up in a wonderful, politically diverse family. Every Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner was one large political argument. So I always say my family trained me for what I do for a living these days. So I grew up in a conservative Republican household in a very New Deal Democratic town. I grew up in a factory town called Fall River, which I still love, about 50 miles south of Boston and right on the Rhode Island border. And so I sort of admired my parents for being such dissenters in this great New England town. And one of the stories I tell at the beginning of the book is, and if there are any older conservatives here, you will remember this, that at the end of the 1964 campaign, everybody knew Barry Goldwater was going to lose. But this guy, this actor called Ronald Reagan, gave this amazing speech on behalf of Goldwater. And at that moment, I still remember the feeling of my 12-year-old conservative self and my dad. We were saying, that's our guy. That's the guy who's going to lead us out of the wilderness. Now, in my case, what happened? Well, how did I become a liberal? First, I had a very open-minded dad. My dad and I loved to argue about politics, and he encouraged it. He thought it was a good thing to argue. He even gave me, at my request, a subscription to the New Republic when I was 13 so I could strengthen my side of the debate. I had a great dad. And it was actual excitement over what was happening with the great society as a 13, 14-year-old, where I sort of had this feeling, wait a minute, these guys are trying to solve a lot of problems. What are we doing? And so I passed through a period of liberal republicanism before I decided that didn't work out very well. I talk quite a bit about the liberal republicans in the book. And then the other thing that was actually a very important experience for me, I was in my Benedictine Catholic school. We had to write a book report on a religious book, and I chose Martin Luther King's Strength to Love. And I don't know if any of you ever read that book, but it's a wonderful book. It's a collection of Dr. King's sermons. And I think I was then about 15 or so. I was a Catholic, a Christian, and suddenly the meaning of Christianity for racial justice and social justice just had to hit you when you read that book. So that sort of began my journey. And so I've pretty much been a person of the center left since I was a late teenager. But I tell the story about having grown up as a conservative in the book partly to say, yes, I come at this as a liberal of kind of social democratic inclinations, but I don't view conservatives as some odd breed of people. I get why people are conservative. Some of the people in my life that I love very much are conservative. So I didn't come at it with a hostility, but I do come at it with a great deal of impatience with what's happened to the right and how far to the right, they moved, and I think that's actually bad for them. I don't know if they'll be persuaded by me on that, but I also think it's very bad for the country, and that's why I think it's the subtitle of the introduction is why fixing the country requires reforming the right, because I do think we need a different kind of conservatism in America.
As you talk about the conversations growing up, and we are the same generation, I think the Goldwater election was the first one that I was engaged in. Of course, I was on the other side.
You did very well in that election.
Yes, yeah. It was a good beginning experience. It just seemed as though people could talk more easily then. I mean, obviously, with your parents, you had a constructive debate. I know people today who have trouble talking with their kids about ideas like that. It seems that even on the family level, it has been more difficult. It has become more difficult to have a civil discussion. Do you think that's the case?
I think there is some truth to that. Although, I go back and forth on this question because I find all the time that, you know, when you travel around the country, there are certainly in smaller communities people who kind of have to get along, and so they manage somehow. Mm-hmm. I find it even with my kids. My youngest daughter is editor of her high school paper, and she's a liberal, and one of her favorite people on the paper is one of the most conservative kids on the paper, and they enjoy bantering and arguing, but she thinks of him as one of the best writers on the paper. So I don't think we're totally hopeless in putting everybody in another camp, but I do think that when you don't know the person face-to-face, that we really tend to turn each other into kind of distant objects. And I think partly the anonymity online can make it easier for people to scream at each other and say things to each other that they probably wouldn't say face-to-face. I think for a long time, politics has sometimes seemed like an argument over which set of sins are most important. And so each side is trying to consign the other to some sort of hell where, the greatest sins are racism, sexism, intolerance, or the greatest sins are a lack of personal responsibility, sexual license, and so on. And, when you sort of don't respect the underlying moral position of your opponent, or at least even understand it, it can get pretty rough out there. And then there is the phenomenon people being able to live in their own cocoons if they really choose to. Now, in my experience, there are a lot of conservatives who read liberals because you should see my angry mail. So I take that as actually a positive sign. So I don't think we may not be cocooning as much as we think, but you certainly can absorb only information that confirms your own view. And, that's a dangerous thing for all of us.
You start with Goldwater, who, even though he lost spectacularly, you see as the beginning of this movement. How much of that is the Reagan interjection there, that famous speech? Do you think without that, Goldwater still would have been the beginning of it all?
Oh, yeah, Goldwater, even without that Reagan speech made Reagan's career. It's interesting, by the way, I'm not sure I mentioned this before, that both Reagan and Obama began their careers with one big speech, Reagan in 64 and Barack Obama, of course, with that great speech at the 2004 Democratic Convention. I think the Goldwater campaign was one of the most consequential events in American political history, because it is what set off the transformation of the Republican Party that kind of leads, not necessarily in a straight line, but in a crooked but direct line to where we are today. It began the purge first of liberals out of the Republican Party, and we forget how many liberals were in the Republican Party. Senator Tom Kuchel of California is a good example, who got beaten in 1968 by Max Rafferty, Jacob Javits in New York, Clifford Case in New Jersey, Ed Brooke in my own Massachusetts. These are all not simply moderate Republicans. These were genuinely progressive Republicans, strong on civil rights, often supported parts of the Great Society. The Goldwater sort of movement, their takeover of the party, began a purge where there really aren't any liberal Republicans left anymore. Then came the purge of the moderate Republicans, where if you were too moderate, you would face a primary, and more of them lost either in primaries, or many of the moderate Republicans came from districts that were largely Democratic. My own District of Maryland had a very, you know, progressive Republican called Connie Morella. And after a while, all the Democrats who had voted for her said, wait a minute, we don't want to empower a right-wing majority in Congress. So even people who liked her voted against her. Mm-hmm. So that happened on the one side. On the other side, Goldwater sort of presided over not only the conservatization of the Republican Party, if that's a good word, but also the southernization of the Republican Party, and that it was because Goldwater was interesting because he wasn't a racist himself. He had supported civil rights laws as a member of the city council in Phoenix, but he sided with the southern segregationists in saying this is not a federal matter. These civil rights laws could violate private property rights. So, you know, he broke the long historic relationship between the Republican Party and African Americans. A third of African Americans had voted for Richard Nixon in 1960. Half of them had voted for Eisenhower in 1956. 6% of African Americans voted for Barry Goldwater. Meanwhile, Southern whites, segregationist conservative Southern whites, shifted in mass to the Republicans. Well, that, you know, for every action, there is a reaction. And what started happening from over a long period of time is a lot of people who had been Republican said, this is not our party anymore. This is a much more conservative party. It is a Southern party. So they started leaving, either becoming independents or, in many cases, becoming Democrats. You really saw that shift in suburban counties all over the country. The collar counties around Philadelphia are a good example. Some of the counties up here are a good example. All that was set in motion by the Goldwater and the very sort of kind of brilliant organizational efforts by the right. And moderate Republicans didn't know what was happening to them until it was too late.
Yeah. I think the Gingrich Revolution was the first time, even though I was, you know, working for a newspaper, fairly focused on politics, that was a wake-up call for me that something different is happening here. You've known Newt for a long time. What's your experience with him?
Yeah, we were talking before we came out, and I said there were three people who from the moment I met them I knew were going very far, and one was Bill Clinton, whom I met in 1988, and I came home and told my wife, this guy's going to be president. The second was Barack Obama, whom I got to know as part of a seminar that Bob Putnam, member of the Bowling Alone, had organized. And he invited this a collection of people from different spheres. And one of them was his first-term state senator called Barack Obama. And by the second meeting, I was calling him Governor Obama. I had the office wrong, but I had the trajectory right. You know, it was just very clear. But the third was Newt Gingrich, who was obviously not my cup of tea politically. But back when I was a foreign correspondent, I actually asked Gingrich's office to send me his book because I found him someone who was intellectually interesting, challenging, and I got to be Newt and I had a very interesting relationship. He was one of the first people I wanted to cover when I came back to be a political correspondent before I was an opinionated columnist. And we used to meet fairly regularly and argue about stuff. Then when he was in power, our relationship got very vexed and we got away. And although, as I said, I one of the things I try to do in Washington, it's a very mean place, or it can be. So whenever somebody loses, I try to get in touch with them because that's when no one is trying to get in touch with them. And so I reconnected with Gingrich by having a friend remind him that he lost a bet we made on the 1992 election on the floor of the Republican convention, and he owed me lunch. And so we reconnected that way. But you're absolutely right that the Republican Revolution in 94 really pushed very far ahead the trends that had been set in motion in 1964. It completed the congressional realignment of the South. Mm-hmm. That for a long time, white Southerners would vote Republican for president, but still re-elect Democrats to the House. There was also some very important redistricting, some of it done in the name of civil rights, that actually produced many more Republican districts as African Americans got moved out of some districts and put into more homogeneously African-American districts. But, you know, if you the numbers are in the book, as I remember them, in 1990, 23% of Republicans had voted for Democratic House candidates. By 1994, that had dropped to 8%. And it's a 94 election that really confirmed the kind of the path to ideological homogeneity and the polarization we're seeing. So in that sense, it's not shocking that this Republican Congress decided to impeach impeach President Clinton, even though the country had just sent a signal in the midterm elections that it didn't want to impeach the president over the Lewinsky mess.
Yeah. Did you think Newt might have the potential to be president? I mean, he ran.
You know, he wasn't. With Clinton and Obama, I really felt they were presidential. I never quite thought Newt was presidential. I just thought he was smart and interesting and would go far. So he did. He did become Speaker. Speaker of the House, so he got pretty far. I never saw him as likely presidential, partly personality-wise, and sometimes at his best he can be intellectually adventurous. You know, at his worst he can sort of be demagogic. But at his best he can be intellectually adventurous, and I wonder sometimes how that would have played in a campaign.
Yeah. I often think of Grover Norquist as being a big part of this movement. How do you see him tying into what's
been how many happening? People here know who Grover Norquist is? What an informed crowd.
Yes, this is the Commonwealth Club.
next time I see him, I'll tell him that this big crowd of liberals has targeted you. Grover is both a representative figure and an important figure. I spoke to a lot of conservatives before I wrote this book, and they were actually fun interviews because they all knew I was a liberal. They all knew I was going to be critical of where the movement was going, but they all understood I was trying to understand what was going on. I don't think any of them were under any illusions they were likely to convert me, though a couple of them still tried. Grover also grew up in Massachusetts like I did, was a Republican, and it stuck with Grover. He's always been a kind of libertarian-leaning, anti-government Republican. He once told me he actually was once assigned to write a sports story, he said, I know nothing about sports. And he came back from the baseball game and he came back with this report that said, well, there was a strike, there was a ball, there was a strike. He said, I wasn't cut out to be a sports writer. but I always thought that was a good Grover story because he is very data oriented. He's very clever about data. He just, in case of sports, it wasn't his cup of tea. But Grover's tax pledge, the pledge that Republicans have to sign and say they will never, ever raise taxes, was significant as kind of representing what happened to the Republican Party in the 80s. I have a chapter on President George H.W. Bush, the Bush family's tradition is very interesting, because if you go back to the grandfather, he was actually an Eisenhower Republican and was quite different. But remember, he represented Connecticut. H.W. moved down to Texas. Politics are a little different in Texas than in Connecticut. In order to win the 88 election and to reassure conservatives, he made his famous pledge, read my lips, no new taxes. And then he broke the pledge for a very good reason, which is we needed to balance the budget. And he made a deal with the Democrats some Democrats that he thought could get through, and Newt Gingrich led the rebellion against it. And it was only after that point that it became utterly impossible for a Republican to say, I'm going to raise taxes. Ronald Reagan, depending on how you want to count it, Ronald Reagan raised taxes about 7 or 8 times after he cut them. And it was only that rebellion against Bush that really made it impossible, and that Grover so kind of institutionalized that in his pledge. He's occasionally figured out, I was educated by Benedictines, but I teach at a Jesuit school, so I can say he's had Jesuitical ways around it when necessary. Yeah. Clearly, I say that with respect. I love Jesuits. It was basically impossible for Republicans ever to support tax increases. And that sort of goes to a larger point in my book. One of my frustrations with the current brand of conservatism is this attitude toward government. As I said earlier, you can't cut government radically without cutting programs people actually want. A lot of Tea Party people, as I note in the book, will say, I'm for cutting government, but I'm not for cutting Social Security or Medicare, because those are earned benefits. It also happens that much of the Tea Party is at or near the age of 65. Okay. Or if you want to increase military spending, as virtually all the Republicans, except for Rand Paul, who dropped out today, want to do, well, that's part of government, too. And one of the heroes of my book is actually Dwight Eisenhower. And what I argue about the Goldwater campaign is that really there were two brands of conservatism on offer at that moment. And one was Barry Goldwater's conservatism, but the other was Dwight Eisenhower's conservatism. Now, since then, things have moved so far right that a lot of people want to say, well, Dwight Eisenhower wasn't really a conservative. Well, he was a balancing the – he was a very fiscally prudent. He was very pro-business. But he was also someone who accepted that there were times, as Republicans have since Lincoln, there were times when the well-being of the country, the future of the country, depends on certain forms of activism by government. So Ike gave us the interstate highway system. Ike gave us the first student loan programs that helped millions, including me, go to college. And so it is possible, I think, there's an Edmund Burke idea where Burke talks about, the job of a statesman is to sort of preserve and improve. And I think that's a good definition of a sensible conservatism, which is conservatives do want to preserve things. They want to tell us liberals, be careful before you overturn certain traditions. But the conservatives, as against reactionaries, do not think the status quo itself is something to be protected, that society does need to advance, and that social improvement ought to be part of conservatism.
You actually identify Bill Clinton as an Eisenhower Republican.
Well, Bill Clinton identified himself as an Eisenhower Republican. And no, it was during the budget fight when Clinton realized that they had invested so much effort in achieving a balanced budget that he looked in frustration to his aides and said, we're nothing but Eisenhower Republicans. And then he added, but at least we'll give them health care, meaning his constituents. And, of course, that part never worked out. What's interesting is the Eisenhower Republicans actually in the electorate returned the favor because, there was a lot of polling done after the 96 election where Republicans who were budget balancers actually gave Clinton quite a few of their votes in 1996. But in certain ways, he was an Eisenhower Republican.
We have a question from the audience that really goes to the possible apocalyptic end of the right revolution. Is the right foraging a new era of reconstruction? There's an attack on voting rights, domestic terrorism, you've got ethnic bias. Do you think that could be a result of the way things are going?
Right, of post really tearing apart Reconstruction. Right. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. Reconstruction was a largely successful effort to empower African Americans in the South. And there was a whole history. History was rewritten in a kind of racist way to suggest that the Reconstruction was nothing but corruption and all of that. That's not true. And then it was followed by what were called the Redeemers. And what they were doing is redeeming the South from Republican and African American control. Does one sense at this moment, some of that politics, I agree, sadly, with some of the some of the underlying premises of the question. If you look at what the Supreme Court did in gutting the Voting Rights Act, breaking with a whole series of precedents in order to take out the heart of the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, that is the kind of thing that happened post Reconstruction the first time around. When you look at laws being passed for voter ID laws to deal with alleged voter fraud, I don't deny that back in the day there were machines, political machines, that could find 120% of the voters in a particular precinct. But the evidence, I'm from Massachusetts, where people pick certain cemeteries because then they won't be deprived of their right to vote after their death. But the the evidence of in-person voter fraud is it's just minuscule. But these laws are passed for voter IDs that disadvantage inner-city people. Inner-city people don't automatically go get driver's licenses the way suburban people do. And some older people who may not have birth certificates. I mean, these are blatant efforts to suppress votes, and they have clear effects. I mean, Texas's law was the most, I suppose, transparent because they denied the use of student IDs to vote but accepted gun licenses. I thought of a whole campaign to arm the whole state of Texas in order to foil the voter ID laws. So I agree. And, you know, when you look at the, I talked earlier about the demographic picture facing Republicans. I mean, they have a couple, there are about three options here. One is to just keep doing what they're doing and face a real long-term problem as the country, Latinos, Asians, African Americans loom as a relatively larger percentage of population than white people do. That's one option. The second option is to change a little to make themselves more appealing to these groups. The third option, and I'm not just some liberal saying this, David Frum, the maverick conservative, also wrote this recently. The third option is, well, maybe we can keep some of those guys from voting and continue, to win. And so I do think, I am very upset by the particularly what's happened with voter suppression. And on the other side, lifting restrictions on campaign money, Citizens United. When you put together those two decisions, on the one side, make it harder for African Americans and other minorities to enforce their right to vote, and then on the other side, empower the very wealthy to have even more influence in our politics. I do not believe we will become an oligarchy, but it does point in that direction. There's something very disturbing to me about the conjunction of those two facts.
Another member of the audience says, is there a Republican presidential candidate that has impressed you in the current race?
Probably the one I like best, and I wrote a column saying this, is John Kasich.
Yeah.
And Kasich is more conservative than I am in many ways. He kind of got me when he fought his own party in Ohio for the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. And at the time, he said a really interesting thing. He had a religious conversion in the 80s after both his parents got killed in a car crash. He takes his faith very seriously, but in a very interesting way, where he said at the time that when we die and go see St. Peter, he's not going to ask us whether we balance the budget. He's going to ask us, what did we do for the least of these? Right. He has spoken up against this very pessimistic tone that's overtaken the Republican Party. Of all of these candidates, the one I think I like the best is John Kasich. Just one other Kasich story. I actually went to Ohio and wrote a column when he was fighting for Medicaid. And there's a wonderful progressive Congregationalist minister who started a progressive Christian group called We Believe Ohio. And I'm interviewing him in his beautiful office in an old downtown church. And this guy would organize a counter-inaugural to Kasich, who had fought Kasich on his sort of moves against the labor unions and other things. And he's sitting there saying how courageous Kasich is on healthcare, and then he stopped for a moment and he looked up and said, I can't believe I'm saying all these nice things about John Kasich. And that was the lead of the column I wrote. So thank you for that question.
Well, we also have some questions about the Democratic side, which certainly has gotten more interesting with Iowa. Do you think Hillary can pull this off?
If I had to bet, I would still bet that Hillary wins the nomination. I mean, I remember that both Iowa and New Hampshire, I think, were well set up for Bernie Sanders. He ran a great campaign, and I'm not taking anything away from the fact that he was behind by 30 or 40 points. But the Iowa caucus is on the Democratic side is historically more liberal than the country as a whole. And obviously, New Hampshire's next door to Vermont, and there's some real affection for Bernie across the border. The column I have actually in tomorrow's paper, I think it might be in the San Jose. I don't know if you ran it for tomorrow, but
I think yeah.
But I talk about how that the Democratic debate is a fascinating debate about the theory of how do you get progressive change. And Clinton is very much a gradualist. And, if you take Bernie's big ideas, break up the big banks, single-payer health care, free college for all, Hillary says, no, what you really need to do is strengthen existing financial reform, build on Obamacare, and we probably shouldn't provide college for everyone, but we have to massively expand the aid we do give to people who need to attend. Mm-hmm. But inherent in that is a belief that gradualism can work. Right. Bernie's theory is that mobilization is necessary to change. When he says political revolution, he wants to overturn the structure of power inside the political system. Thus, he goes after the political money. Thus, he talks about shifting white working class voters away from the Republicans. Thus, he talks about bringing in voters who haven't voted before. Now, what I argue in the column is that one of the reasons this race is close is because a lot of Democrats actually have sympathy for both of those views. That on the one hand, they probably are in the majority gradualists the way Clinton is, would accept the idea that we couldn't successfully impose single-payer health care very quickly. On the other hand, they agree with Bernie's critique that even gradual reform is not possible unless you change some of the underlying structures in the system. And so I argue it's a very dialectical primary because I think a lot of voters are looking for a kind of synthesis between Bernieism and Hillaryism in the sense that they'd like some of the initiatives in terms of organizing and talking about inequality the way Bernie is, but kind of respect Clinton's one step at a time. You're going to get knocked down a lot and you have to get up again and keep moving forward approach to politics.
What do you think would happen with the Bernie Sanders-Donald Trump contest in the fall?
Somebody in the New Yorker wrote that it would be a debate between the two of them would sound like an argument on the 41 bus to King's Plaza in Brooklyn between a guy from Queens and a guy from Brooklyn. I do not think that is a likely outcome. B, that is the one race that might entice Mike Bloomberg to
yes,
run.
That's true.
I think that's the only circumstance that I think is plausible that Bloomberg might do it. But the polls suggest Bernie would beat Trump in that election. But it would be quite a race.
Be an ugly bus ride, I think.
Really interesting, though. I wouldn't mind overhearing that debate.
Yeah, yeah. this is a question that really is addressed in your book, but let's talk about it.
So much
please,
the better. That's
yeah, yes. Please comment on the right-wing talk radio media's role in pushing the conservative movement off the cliff. Whatever happened to the Bill Buckley types?
Thanks for the... I have a great affection, actually, for Bill Buckley. I've always said if I could be 5% as effective for my side as he was for his, I could leave this world a happy person. On the other hand, I also point out, by the way, that Buckley and National Review in the 50s and early 60s are on the wrong side of the race issue. And Buckley himself acknowledged that later in life, which I respected him for. But I do talk quite a lot in the book about the role of race and racial backlash in creating the new Republican Party. Nonetheless, when you think of Bill Buckley's old show, Firing Line, and anybody who's never seen that show should look it up online, because these were great arguments. And Buckley would invite really smart liberals and lefties to argue with him. Now, that was partly because he had enough self-confidence to think he'd win. But they were really serious arguments. And this is totally off subject, but it's one of my favorite Buckley stories, where he debated the late Michael Harrington. Some of you may remember wrote the book Together America, who was a socialist. He'd be very interested in Bernie Sanders' campaign. And this tells you something about what Bernie has achieved, actually, because Buckley said once, Mr. Harrington is America's leading socialist. That would be a bit like being the tallest building in Topeka. but he loved arguing with Mike. So just to get to your question, the talk radio and Fox News have become like the holy office that determines orthodoxy. I mean, they have the ability, they have really taken significant power away from the elected leadership of the Republican Party. One of my colleagues once said that if you need to interview a Republican congressman quick, just hang out right outside the Fox News studio near the Capitol, and everybody's going to be coming by at some point. And so this presses the party to the right, but it's also the talk radio in conjunction with the conservative money, as I said, what Frum called the radical rich. You know, between the two of them, this explains, for example, I think particularly why so many Republicans have backed off acknowledging climate change. I mean, we forget that as recently as 8 years ago, John McCain had a fairly progressive piece of legislation introduced with Joe Lieberman to deal with climate change. It used to be possible to be a Republican and say, yes, climate change is real and we ought to figure out how to do something about it. And the Republicans would say, we want to be more market-oriented in our solution. But they would acknowledge that there was a problem. And now that is very, very difficult. So I do write a lot about that. And one of the other points I make in the book that just, if I could sort of make it here, because it's sort of TV that reminds me of it, is a lot of the ideas that the Tea Party put forward were already present in the thinking of a lot of the folks in the John Birch Society. If you go back to Glenn Beck's show, back when he was on Fox, he had this reading list. And some of the important books on the reading list were old John Birch Society books. So my chapter on sort of this phenomenon is called The New Old Right. And it is the same old right, but they have certain assets now, including talk radio and Fox News.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Another member of the audience asks, why have the Republicans been so successful in moving the Democrats to the right? Why haven't the Democrats stood up for the New Deal programs and advanced them?
Well, that's a long story, and I talk about it in the book. I found a great let me see while I answer it. I want to find this quote, which I like. You know, to some degree, the Bill Clinton years were a necessary response to the Reagan years, that Democrats did need to prove themselves to be fiscally responsible and good stewards and all of that. You know, they needed to be tough on crime, although what they ended up doing is pass a crime bill that even Bill Clinton now feels went too far in creating this problem of mass incarceration. But I also think, and I argue in the book, that Clinton may have given up more ground than he should have, particularly when he said that you know, the era of big government is over. That just wasn't factually true, and it was a kind of concession. And so I think that the progressives kind of helped narrow the political spectrum in a way that, you know, whatever you think of Sanders, whether you're for Hillary or Sanders, he's actually broadening the conversation again showing what a real socialist is like and not somebody like Barack Obama, of whom I have often said that my socialist friends are insulted when Barack Obama is called a socialist, because here's a guy who presides over a rather healthy, at least until the last couple of weeks, boom on Wall Street. I just want to read this Irving Howe quote, because Irving Howe, some of you know, was a great socialist intellectual and a great writer. And I just ran across a piece he wrote in the middle of the Goldwater campaign, and he said, a law might be here advanced about recent American politics. This is back in 1964. The more housebroken the left, the more adventuresome the right. And that goes directly to the point of your question, whoever you are out there.
You write in the book about the disappointment in Barack Obama within his own party in those early years, really up to fairly recently, when he kept trying to look for that middle ground, and the Nancy Pelosi's of the world said, "What middle ground?"
Well, there's a great moment when Nancy Pelosi said to President Obama, Mr. President, I don't mind it that you're throwing us under the bus. What I object to is that you're backing the bus up and running us over again. And there was a period where I think this was a combination of Obama's sincere belief that he actually could change the Republicans' mind. And I have a little section of the book about how Obama got elected president of the Harvard Law Review by conservatives, because the conservative minority on the Harvard Law Review felt that Barack Obama was more open-minded, more open to them than the other liberal alternatives. And so he won these conservative votes. And he'd always been quite successful at dealing with conservatives and Republicans when he was a state legislator. And so he actually thought he could do it. I think there was a second part of it, which is he and his aides believed that they had made a big deal of trying to end this partisan rancor, and so they ought to try to do it. Now, what I argue in the book is it was quite obvious right from the start that this was not going to happen. The stimulus got and the economy is about to collapse. Passing an economic stimulus is what Republicans as well as Democrats had done, and here we were facing as big a collapse as we had, potential collapse as we had faced since the Great Depression. He could only find three Republican senators who would help him on the Senate side to get past a filibuster because Al Franken hadn't won his race yet. Yeah. We remember there were only 59 Democrats at that point. I argue in the book that I think it should have been obvious to Obama early on that this was not going to work. And they let the health care bill, it took so much time to produce, partly because they kept hoping that they would get some Republican support that was never going to be there. Now, Obama actually believes this critique himself now. As you can tell, he's toughened up over the years. I think that, there was a break point in 2011, where he gave a great speech in Osawatomie, where Teddy Roosevelt had given a great speech sort of setting up the progressive campaign that he later ran. So I think he came to see this. I think it would have been useful if he had seen it earlier. Their view was, we got to try to keep the promise and maybe we can make some progress. And like a lot of persuasive people, Obama thought somehow he could persuade these guys, but it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah,
In fact, in the book, I should say, I tell the story of on his inauguration day, and I draw this from Robert Draper's very good book on the Republicans in the House. There was a dinner of a lot of the Republican leaders, including Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy and Eric Cantor, where they basically said, we got to go start defeating him immediately. And that was on the day of his inauguration. A month later, Mitch McConnell laid out his strategy of how he was going to foil the president to his Republican colleagues. So this wasn't in the cards. And yes, he could have invited more people to the White House. A little more schmoozing would be nice. You wish that Bill Clinton had a little bit of Obama's discipline gene and Obama had a little bit of Clinton's schmoozing gene, and then you'd have one of the greatest politicians ever invented. But none of that, I think, is fundamental. I think it was ideology and a political strategy, which, if you're a Republican, it gave you the House in 2010 and gave you both of them in 2014. So you can see why they pursued it.
So you talk at length in the book about the Tea Party, and even though the Tea Party's roots were in the Bush administration, the element of race really, I think, amped up the voice. How much do you think that dinner, for instance, do you think that dinner would have happened if the new president were someone of Barack Obama's really fairly moderate, not at all socialist views, had been elected president? How much do you think race affected that?
I try to be very careful about race in the book, and I think sometimes we are either too reluctant to talk about it on the one hand or try to attribute everything to it on the other. I mean, let's face it, the Republicans didn't like Bill Clinton very much either, and they actually impeached him. So far, that still hasn't happened to President Obama. Now, you can say he hasn't given them grounds to, but they've taken him to court a lot. But I also argue that there is, you know, it is built into the Republican, race is built into the Republican coalition. And I go all the way back to the 30s and 40s. The New Deal coalition started falling apart around race in the late 30s. Mm-hmm. I discovered through the work of a great writer, Ira Katznelson, a book called Wither Solid South, written by a segregationist intellectual in 1947, which basically predicted over time that Southern white conservatives were going to have to ally with the Republican Party as the party of states' rights that opposed federal action in a whole lot of spheres. And that, you know, the early conservative movement was very open in seeing an alliance with Southern conservatives, who then included Southern segregationists. So race was there from the beginning. Now, with Barack Obama, I think there was a specifically racial element of the opposition, and there was an ideological element of the opposition. And then there was also an element that I think is Obama as a kind of cosmopolitan figure who was sort of alien and different than a lot of people, some people in the country could identify with. To say that race had nothing to do with it is just to ignore all the polling data or this interesting fact that in 22% of the counties of America, Barack Obama ran behind John Kerry's vote in 2004. The New York Times did this wonderful map where you had these counties form what a friend of mine called the red slash across the middle of the country that went down from Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, through West Virginia, down across the Appalachians, down into Arkansas, Louisiana, East Texas. It's irreducibly, there's a racial element, there's race going on here. And Tea Party members tended to give much more conservative answers on race. But, as I say, they didn't like Bill Clinton very much. There would have been, I think, a similar kind of opposition if Hillary Clinton had been president, but it had an extra edge because of the president's race.
Yeah, I have a number of people asking, and I've wondered myself if Hillary self-destructs further, if the email situation gets to be, you know, something legally serious. Is Joe Biden waiting in the wings? Could Elizabeth Warren jump in?
I guess I'd preface, one always has to be careful when premises are built into questions and then you end up saying things that you don't intend to say. So I would say, if I were to guess, I don't think she'll self-destruct.
Right.
But do I think that Joe Biden would jump into the race if it seemed that the Democrats needed someone else? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. He's almost said it himself that he sort of half regrets his decision not to jump in. I don't think Elizabeth Warren can jump in now because Bernie has occupied all the space that she would occupy or would have occupied. But sure, I think Biden is ready to run for president if the circumstance is there. I don't know where the legal case is going. I'd be more surprised than not if she actually faced a legal problem, but I've been wrong before.
Yeah, the whole classification system seems to be
I think it would be difficult to the documents themselves weren't stamped classified, even if there were reason to call them classified. Yeah. And I don't know how that's going to play out with the law. But
again, an audience question. Some on the right oppose infrastructure spending because it's considered helping the government. In the wake of Flint, Michigan, and how short-sighted is that? I mean,
the person knows the answer to that question. The feeling I have.
But just for a point of discussion.
It's just one anecdote. Steve LaTourette is a former Republican congressman from Ohio, whom I talk with for the book. And he left Congress, and he told me, and he was a big, there's a little construction union Republican caucus where there are a bunch of Republicans who got supported by some of the construction trades unions. And so LaTourette really likes to build stuff. And he said he left Congress when we couldn't even pass a transportation bill anymore. And you talk about something deeply embedded in the Republican tradition. I mean, these are the internal improvements. You know, I always thought, Henry Clay called them internal improvements. I always thought maybe if we called infrastructure internal improvements, we could get them passed, because it's a much nicer word than infrastructure. But, you know, he and Abraham Lincoln, I mean, this was deep in the Republican tradition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, clearly a lot of Republican governors want to do some highways and do some roads and fix the airports. Mm-hmm. And it's partly it's that inability to say, well, maybe we can raise taxes a little bit to achieve a certain end. In order to pass the transportation bill they just passed, they kind of raided Federal Reserve funds. But there are conservatives who basically only want that done at the local level, and I suppose they might even vote against bond issues at those levels. But yeah. I do. That's where I really, you know, I know most conservatives know in their hearts that we need government to solve certain problems. There are certain things we have to do together because we can't do them alone. Mm-hmm. And I wish they'd abandon some of this rhetoric, and then we could argue about spending levels. Maybe I want to spend more than they do. Maybe I want a more progressive tax system than they do, which I probably do, which I actually do. I have a long section on Jack Kemp, who would always write me a very chiding but sweet note whenever I propose to raise taxes, which is, you know, not infrequent in my case. They know this rhetoric doesn't make sense at some level, and I'd love them to just say that, and then we can have a bit more rational argument about things.
Yeah, a rational argument would be nice. Who are your political heroes?
Who are my political heroes? That's Robert Kennedy. Gene McCarthy, I'm one of the only people in the world who likes both of them. Usually if you like Gene, you hated Bobby, and if you like Bobby, you hated Gene. So those are two particular people in my lifetime. Republican Mac Mathias, the senator from Maryland, who was a civil rights progressive Republican, who was an extraordinary person. Going back historically, my wife gave me for Christmas or my birthday one of my favorite political posters, which is a Roosevelt Truman poster from 1944, and that hangs in our breakfast nook. You know, my poor children growing up around all this. Our poor children growing up around all the. But I think they should know about Roosevelt and Truman. Obviously, Lincoln. You know, Lincoln for a lot of reasons, actually, including. You know, his real sense of us as a nation of the role of government and of his, you know, interestingly, his take on the Declaration of Independence and what it means was remarkably similar to Martin Luther King's. You know, if you look at the rhetoric on this, they are very similar. And John Quincy Adams, and that's partly my Massachusetts roots, partly because of where he stood on slavery, on the rights of Native Americans. And he gave, check out his 1825 message to Congress, which is one of the most forward-looking documents. It envisioned space research. He was a really extraordinary character. And John Quincy Adams doesn't get his due, so I always like to give him a plug.
Well, I am told we're coming up on what has to be our last question, which I think is unfortunate. But we just can't resist. What do you think is going to happen in this presidential race? Who's going to be the Republican nominee, and how's it all going to turn out?
One of my favorite journalistic phone calls was when I was a correspondent in Paris. I was often called upon to write about a civil war that was happening in Chad, because it was often easier to get information in Paris than it was in Chad. And I'll never forget calling the Chad embassy and asking an official at the Chad embassy what was about a battle and what had gone on. And he said, you know, what do I know? I mean, it's a big desert down there, said the gentleman. And I feel like, as a political journalist looking at this race, I feel like saying, what do I know? How right have we been about anything up to now? I think in the long run, Hillary Clinton, unless something radical happens, I think in the end Hillary Clinton will prevail, but it will be a long campaign because Democrats have certain ambivalences about the two. They kind of like both of them in certain different ways. And because Bernie's extraordinary small donor base will allow him to fund himself for a very, very long time. I think if Clinton does win, she's going to need Bernie Sanders to turn out those young voters who are rallying to him. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how that relationship works. On the Republican side, the logic of my book, as well as the logic of my friends Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein's book, you know, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, a great book, by the way. I'm not, yeah. I'll try to sell their book too. Point, you know, that Ted Cruz is the most logical nominee in that respect.
Yeah.
And the reason, a lot of Cruz supporters here.
Yeah.
But the reason I think that is Cruz has the most coherent strategy in terms of uniting the key right-wing parts of the right end of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
The popular wisdom right now is that Marco Rubio is the guy who eventually will prevail. I'm not persuaded of that yet. I think so much will depend on whether there really is a bounce out of Iowa that allows him to push back everybody else on his side of the party, particularly Kasich, Christie, and Bush. If he really does that in New Hampshire, then you are looking at a long sort of battle down the road. I think if Trump had won in Iowa, I think there was a very plausible path for him, because I think he could have gone bang, bang, bang in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. I think that's less certain. That's less certain now. So if you put a gun to my head, I'd say Cruz, but you're not putting a gun to my head, and so I'll punt.
I think our audience will put a gun to its collective head if it is Cruz.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank E.J. Dionne. Wonderful
great.
Conversation.
No, thank you.
Author.
Thank you.
Author of, for our radio audience, author of Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. I'd like to thank our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio and the web. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.